We started a series 2 Sundays ago, short series, which we're going to look at some of the things that are part of our culture. And sometimes we don't notice them, and yet they are sinful. And we call the series Hidden in Plain Sight, because they're there all the time, but we don't always see them. And a couple of Sundays ago, we looked at the issue of sectarianism. And next Sunday, Michael's going to be looking at the issue of consumerism. What better time to think about that than Christmas? But today, we're going to look at secularism. And if we're not familiar with that word, the word secularism, we are familiar with the noun, secular. And we use that word normally in distinction from sacred. It's the way we kind of break life up into the stuff that's religious and the stuff that's ordinary, the sacred and the secular. So when we talk about a secular society, which we sometimes do, we mean a society which doesn't believe in God. That, so far as society is concerned, it's a purely secular world. It is as if there were no God, and everything that we do and all of our values and all the things that we are involved in presuppose the fact that God is not a part of that equation, okay? It's just you and me, and God isn't there. And that's normally what we mean by a secular society. Actually, that's not what secularism means at all. It's popularly how we use it. The term secularism is actually a technical term, and its context is the tragedy, which is religious war. Throughout the history of the world, many people have died in religious wars, and some of those wars have been going on for a very long time. For example, we're kind of horrified and astounded in the 21st century that Muslims have become what appears to us to be really intransigent people and get themselves involved, or at least some people who are Muslim get themselves involved in acts of terrorism, like some of the things that have happened in mainland UK or in the United States within the last 10 or 12 years. But in actual fact, Christians and Muslims have been at war for centuries. It goes back way back in time, back to the Crusades and even before that. It's a war that has been going on for a long time. But in the context of Europe, the greatest concentration of religious wars came in the period of history immediately following the Reformation, when Europe was divided largely between Roman Catholic and Protestant. One of those wars, for example, began in 1618, went on for 30 years in the midst of Europe. And although it had other features to it, a religious cause was the main reason why that war began in the country largely now that we call Germany. And it lasted for 30 years. And religious wars were really common after the Reformation, and they came to a point where there was a sort of a uneasy peace, which centered around a basic and very simple principle, which was expressed in the Latin phrase, which you'll all immediately recognize, and you're going to be really impressed that I know any Latin phrases at all, but it was expressed in the Latin phrase, cuius regio eius religio. Very simple. Okay, what it mean? It meant the religion of the prince is the religion of the people. So if the prince was Protestant, the state was Protestant. If the prince was Catholic, the state was Catholic. And that's the way they worked it out. And it kind of enabled a sort of uneasy peace in Europe. And European countries were by and large divided up into either being Protestant or Catholic. And that was the solution they came to. However, in the 18th century, things changed. There was a philosophical movement called the Enlightenment, which began to sort of begin to break away from religious loyalties. And they came up with a new solution to the problem, and the new solution was secularism, which meant what? It meant the separation of church and state. And America, the United States of America, is the classic example of that solution to the religious problem, where by law, by the constitution of the country, religion and the church and state are legally separate, and the state has nothing to do with the church. And that's what strictly what secularism actually means. And when secularism began to come in the 18th century, lots of Christians welcomed it. The founding fathers of the United States of America, the people who wrote its constitution, were largely Christian. And they welcomed this secularism, this division between church and state. Why? Because it provided for religious freedom. You could belong to any religion you want and worship in any way you like. The state didn't have a view about your religion. The state wasn't involved in your religion, so all religions could prosper. And it provided for religious freedom, and it provided for peace. Secularism. That's what it actually is. Which now lets you know that when you call the United Kingdom a secular state, you're actually technically incorrect. Because we live in a country where church and state are not separate. The United Kingdom has an established church, the Church of England. The monarch is the head of that church. So our state, technically speaking, still has the old-fashioned model. In reality, however, secularism, which initially was the separation of church and state, brought along with it several other things that are very much a part of our life in the United Kingdom. Two things. And we suffer from them. What are they? First of all, the distinction between policy and morality. When a judge judges a case in court, that judge is not concerned with the morality of the case before him, but with the policy of the government as enshrined in the laws. So, for example, if you take something like abortion, the judge has not got to decide, if he's deciding on a case, whether abortion is right or wrong. He only has to decide if the case before him is within the policy of the state. And the policy of the state is that abortion is legal up to a certain number of weeks in pregnancy. And occasionally beyond that in exceptional circumstances. And all the judge has to make his mind up is, not is this right or wrong, but is this legal or not? And that's true in every area of life. It's not about right and wrong. It's about the policy of the state as enshrined in the law. So there's a division between policy and morality. That's the first division that secularism brought. The second one was this, a distinction between fact and faith. Some things in life we know, like 2 plus 2 equals 4. We can demonstrate that mathematically. Other things we know because we can demonstrate them scientifically. But if I make a statement that God is love, for example, that can't be demonstrated in the same way in which it's possible to demonstrate that 2 plus 2 equals 4. Therefore, says the secularist, there's a difference between what you know as fact and what you know by faith. And what you know by fact is public. And it's the possession of the whole state and our culture. But what you know by faith is private. It's for you and your family and your church, but it's nothing to do with the public sphere. So you don't talk about God and you don't talk about faith in the public sphere. On the BBC website, there's an interesting article about secularism. And one of the things it says in the article is this. Some secularists go further. They want religion to be regarded as a private matter for the home and place of worship, and that the state should be blind to religion. No religion should be taught as fact, and no religion described as superior to another. So although secularism technically means the separation of church and state, in fact what it means is a way of life in which morality is divorced from policy, and the state no longer asks questions about right and wrong, just about what is acceptable to it. And a distinction between faith and fact. And facts are things that we can all talk about and have television programs about and have public discussions about and expect MPs and other people to talk about. But faith is a private matter, to be kept a private matter and not to be talked about in the public square. We had a good example of this as a congregation when a few years ago our Alpha team approached the Newton Abbey Borough Council to ask them could we run an Alpha course in the restaurant in Mosley Mill, and they said no. Said we could do it in the sports centres or in other places like that, but we couldn't do it in the headquarters of the council because that was a public building and matters of faith are not to be promoted there. That's secularism. That's saying that faith is a private matter for you and for me in our own homes or in the context of worship, but not something for council property. Secularism. And the whole direction of secularism is enshrined classically in that song that you'll probably know. You might even like it. John Lennon's song, Imagine. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. That's the secular dream. Turn religion into a private matter, divorce it from the public square, and then we can all live in peace. It's the world we live in. It's all around us, every day. It's the assumption behind many of the television programs you watch. Much of the policy of our government, whether it's Labour or Conservative, makes no odds. What do we do about it? Well, some Christians want to go back. They want to turn the clock back to the days when the church, as of right, had a privileged position in society. You know? And when councils, certainly on mainland UK, could send out Christmas cards instead of ridiculous cards about season's greetings and stuff like that, but they can't do anymore. We'd like want to turn the clock back and go back to the day when the Christian church was in a privileged position, and that's what we want to do. That's not going to be possible, nor is it desirable. The interesting thing is this, that rather than killing off religious practice, secularism in the United Kingdom and in other Western countries has actually heralded an outburst of religious interest. Not all Christian. All kinds of weird and wonderful religions and sects have appeared all over the place. America is, in theory, the most secular country in the world because of its constitution. It's also probably the most religious country in the world. So what do? If we can't go back, the answer is we concentrate on three things that we do and are as the people of God. And interestingly, these three things are the caption on the very front of our congregational website. If you look up our website, you'll see it says Carn Money Church, and underneath it, it says Worship, Community, Witness. I want to suggest this morning that that's how we deal with the issue of the secular world in which we live. Through worship, community, and witness. We deal with it, first of all, through worship. Praise is all but absent from the world of our day. Skepticism rules in every area, and especially where people put themselves forward into the public view. The newspapers, by and large, make a business out of trying to do everything they possibly can to get you to believe that every single member of parliament and anybody else who has a public profile in the church or any other area of society is some kind of reprobate who is not to be trusted in any way. That's basically what they do. And that kind of attitude, that skepticism about public figures who look really nicey-nicey on the outside but couldn't possibly be like that on the inside, is also the kind of attitude to life that drives things like Strictly Come Dancing and X Factor. Why do we enjoy them so much? Well, it's really good listening to Bruno last night describing a member of Parliament as looking something like a Dalek, I think was the phrase he used. And the same on X Factor. Everybody loves Simon Cowell, even though he is ridiculously rude and unfair to all sorts of people and put people up there to make a laugh of them. Why? Because we live in a world where there is very little praise. We spend our lives undermining the public figures whom we're supposed to trust. Whereas in worship, we are called to praise someone about whom there is no dark side. We call people to worship God because He is worthy of worship. And you can dig all you like from now to eternity, all the gutter press, and they will never find a single thing against Him. Wasn't that the problem with Jesus? Even the authorities of his day, they couldn't find a way to convict him. He had to convict himself by saying some things that allowed him to be charged with blasphemy. Even Pilate, a Roman governor, said, "I find no fault in him." We come to worship a God who, in spite of all the things that are around us, is a God who is always worthy of our praise. I played a clip here a few Sunday nights ago from a DVD. It's a Hillsong worship DVD, and on that particular DVD, a girl, Jill McLaughlin, sings a song called Desert Song. The reality is that about a week before that DVD was recorded, Jill McLaughlin's first child was born and died. She was born very prematurely and died just a few days after its birth, and she was scheduled to sing on the DVD. And she decided to go ahead and do it. And you can see her sing the song on the DVD. It's called Desert Song. And the chorus of the song goes like this. And she sings it. Remember the situation in which she's singing it. All of my life, in every season, you are still God. I have a reason to sing. I have a reason to worship. Even in the darkness of the difficult moments of life, Christian worship declares that there is a God who is still worthy of praise. And that stands in such sharp contrast to the world in which we live, that it's part of the means whereby we undermine the nefarious influence of secularism and the skepticism that goes with it in the society to which we belong, by worshiping God. And also because that worship includes thanksgiving, which is also absent in our world. Nobody gives thanks anymore because everybody has rights. Everything we have and what we are, it's our right. And so we don't need to thank anybody for it because we deserve it. We work for it, we earn it, or we just should have it because we are human beings living in the world. And so thanksgiving is largely divorced from the world in which we live. But when we come to worship, it's different. Leslie Newbegin, in his book on society in the 20th century, says this: the Christian congregation meets as a community that acknowledges that it lives by the amazing grace of a boundless kindness. When we come to church, rights fall away. What we deserve, what we think we should have, are no longer of any significance, because in this place and before this God, we are accepted on the basis of grace and on no other basis. So worship is about thanksgiving, because we are dependent upon God and we want to say thank you to Him for constantly showing up for us. In the psalm we read, which starts with that declaration about the foolishness of atheism, it says, "Oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion. When the Lord restores the fortunes of His people, let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad." This is a place of thanksgiving and worship. A place where we fall before someone who is worthy of everything we can say about Him. And where we fall before the face of someone who, because of His grace, deserves to be thanked. Worship is the first great corrective to the secular world in which we live. The second great corrective is community. Community. Leslie Newbegin has also said, Jesus never wrote a book, but He left behind a community. The church is meant to model an alternative way of life to that which exists all around us in the secular society. Life in the secular society is typified by what? By individualism, for example. I am the only person who matters to me. My needs, my progress in life, my safety and my security, it's me, me, me. It's an individualistic world. That's the way we're taught to think. Remember Margaret Thatcher's famous phrase, there is no such thing as society. It's just people, just individuals. Whereas the Church of Jesus Christ is what? It is a body, Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. A body which is given gifts, and those gifts are used for mutual benefit. So the church is meant to model that. As you and I support each other and work for each other and use the gifts that God has given us to look after one another, then we are expressing what kingdom life is meant to be. But the church doesn't just live for itself. Although we are a body and we are given gifts so that we should sustain one another and sustain the life of the fellowship, the church is not living for itself, but gets involved in the concerns of its locality. The church is given these gifts for the mutual support of one another so that we can reach the world that is outside us. It's really interesting that in the New Testament, the word church is qualified by only two kinds of other words. And it is never qualified by the kind of word that we usually qualify it with. We say Presbyterian Church, Baptist Church, Methodist Church, Church of Ireland. You'll not find that anywhere in the New Testament. The word church is never qualified in that way. How is it qualified? In two ways. For example, in Acts chapter 20 and verse 28, this is one way in which the church is constantly qualified in the New Testament. This is Paul talking to the elders in Ephesus. He says, "Keep watch over yourselves and all the flock of which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. Be shepherds of the church of God, which he bought with his own blood. The first way in which the word church is qualified in the New Testament is by the words God and Jesus Christ, or Lord. In other words, the church is something that belongs to God. So it has a vertical reference point. It's not our church, it's his. The second way in which the word church is qualified in the New Testament, you find, for example, in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 1. Now, it's not Paul talking to the elders at Ephesus, it's Jesus talking to the church. And he says this, to the angel of the church in Ephesus, write. It's never qualified denominationally anywhere in the New Testament. But it is qualified by location. The church in Ephesus, the church in so-and-so's home. And it keeps coming up like that again and again. The church in Corinth and so on. So the church is not just a place with a vertical reference to God, whose church it is, but it is a church with a horizontal reference to the locality in which it finds itself. Community, therefore, is the second way that we undermine a society which is typified by individualism, because we live for one another and for the world that is outside our doors. Which is why we have a CAP program here, which is why we'd have a food program here, which is why in this particular church we seek to reach out to Newton Abbey itself. We have that as a name. We have it constantly before us in our thinking. Why? Because we are the new community and we're trying to grow it by reaching out to touch the needs of that other community that lives all around us in this place. We undermine secularism as we become the community of God's people in Newton Abbey. That's who we are, Carn Money Church. It talks about our relationship to God and our relationship to our district. Community. Lastly, witness. We are also to be a voice of hope in a hopeless world. We are to be people who actually believe what we teach and live it out. We believe there is hope. We shouldn't be living like as if we were hopeless. We believe that in the presence of God there is joy. Then we shouldn't be living in such a sad way. We should live out and believe what we actually teach to others, but we are to do it in a particular way. And Peter talks about this in his first letter, chapter 2. He says it twice, because he knows that people don't always pick it up the first time round. So he says it twice in the one chapter. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5 and verse 9. Peter says, "You also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." Then in verse 9, "You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light." Can't miss it. We are called to be priests. And what do priests do? Priests do two things. Priests represent the people before God because they come from a nation. They come from a family. The priests are just ordinary people like us. But they represent ordinary people like us before God. And at the same time, priests represent God before the people. They have this kind of dual mandate. And that's what Peter is saying. That's what Christians are. They are people who represent the people before God and who represent God before the people. You are Jesus to the people you work with, to the people you live with, to the people you share opportunities for recreation with. You are Jesus to those people. And you take those people to Jesus in your prayers. Where are we supposed to do that? Not in here. We come in here to be equipped to do that, to be encouraged to do it, to be renewed and blessed and helped. But we do it out there in the world in which we live. What we do in here prepares us for out there. It's one of the reasons why we run our Alpha courses and CORES and not in the church. We do it that way because we're trying to be in that community and to be Jesus to those people who come. That's why we were so delighted to get the offer to use the house on the Ballyclare Road that's become our prayer house. Why? So we could put prayer out into the middle of the community. We want to go there so that we can be Jesus to those people and bring those people to Jesus. Eugene Peterson, in one of his books, says that he always saw the ministry as pronouncing the name of God in places where it would never be pronounced except as a swear word. To represent God to the people everywhere he went. You and I are called to be priests. To be a priest in the place where we work. To be a priest in the family in which we live. To be a priest where we have recreation and shop and do all the things we do every day. To take those people onto our hearts and to go to God for them. And then to bring God to them by how we live our lives and how we testify, as Peter says, to the glorious riches of his grace. We're reading a book in staff at the moment, and just a week or so ago there was a point made in it that had never really struck me so forcibly before. One of the problems for believers living in a secular society is that we are constantly saying how dark it is, you know? Look at all the evil that goes on. Look at all the wrong motives and the wrong actions and the wrong values that are all around us in the world in which we live. Isn't it terribly dark? And we blame that society for being dark. The writer of the book was pointing out, what is the point of blaming darkness for being dark? It's what it is. If the darkness is dark, it's not the fault of the darkness. It's the fault of the light that hasn't been shining. If the secular world of the 21st century in the UK is dark, it's not the fault of the people out there. It's the fault of the light that isn't shining. And that's us. We are meant to be priests out in the world, representing the people to God and God to the people, so that this dark age in which we live should become bright as the day. How are we going to approach a secular society? By worship, inviting people into a place where someone is worthy of praise. Through community, through building a community that will model what the kingdom of God is like and then become a community that reaches out to everyone around us. And through witness, by being a kingdom of priests who exercise our priesthood out there in the world, challenging people about the reality of God and bringing the needs of people to the one God who can change their lives. That's how we can do it. That's who we are.